Hey guys, this is the atypical opening for our next episode, and this is the second republished episode for Jim Jarrus. This is the original episode 181. The previous one was episode 66, where we talk a little bit more about hazmat codes, and this is incredibly informational stuff. Jim was just a wealth of knowledge. I mean, like in a walking encyclopedia of codes. If there was one person, we always joke about this on the podcast, is that we might not know anything, everything, but we have an incredible Rolodex, and Jim was the hazmat code guy, and or the code guy in itself. So this is a republish of the podcast 181 with Jim Jarrus. Rest in peace, Jim. You are a good dude. Hey everybody, I'm Bobby Salveson.
And I'm Michael Monaco, and together we are the Hazmat Guys, connecting the hazmat community near and far with knowledge, insight, and real-world examples in an effort to make your job just a little bit easier and safer.
Now, let's take a minute to hear from today's sponsors. Hey, Mike, let me ask you, have you ever heard about the bar method?
Have not, but it sure sounds like fun. What does it mean?
Well, probably not what you think it stands for, but what they mean is blot, apply, and remove. It's the new way to remember the steps to conduct hybrid decon.
Okay, I'm listening.
Well, with the threats continuing to evolve, our SOPs do as well. And First Line Technology introduced us to the bar method. It's backed by science and real-world application. This method of blot, apply, and remove is faster, safer, and more effective method to decon.
Is it going to work for both wet and dry?
Yeah, absolutely. The methodology forces you to consider the who, what, when, and where before determining what materials you will be used to carry out the necessary actions. It helps you to tailor your decon to the threats you're facing.
This could be exactly the thing I need to train my team on. How can I get more info?
Well, First Line's EDS kit has everything you need to conduct the hybrid decon for large or small missions. To learn about the kit and how to apply this bar method, visit www.firstlinetech.com/EDS. You know, it's time to rethink your level A protection. Multi-threat suits made of lightweight Gore Chempak Ultra Barrier Fabric are part of the most functional non-encapsulated level A ensembles that bring an essential modernization to hazmat PPE. Certified NFPA 1994 Class 1 suits with Gore Chempak Ultra Barrier Fabric offer unencumbered movement, increased range of motion, improved peripheral visibility, excellent dexterity, and reduced heat stress so you can stay engaged longer. You can learn more at GoreTexProfessional.com. Let's get to the show. Hey guys, Bobby here with the Hazmat Guys, and Mike is out on assignment. So instead of listening to me have my drivel for whatever 30 minutes or so, I have brought on a good friend of mine. As you all know, I have just gotten back from the National Fire Academy, and I would like to bring on one of the guys that really kind of brought me into this whole thing. Before that, I would like to throw out, a guy saw me on campus. His name is Curtis, and he told his friend Steve, that is a listener of ours, that he saw me. So I would like to give a call out to those two guys. I will be in Midwest Conference coming up next weekend. So when you listen to this podcast, it will be 1 week away. And then Mike will be in the Cold Zone Conference shortly thereafter. So come and check us out there. I would like to introduce my good friend. If you want to hear the part one of this, go back to episode 66. This is Jim Jarrus. Say hi.
Hi,
Jim.
How you doing?
Good. But Jim was one of my instructors there, along with Cotton Thompson, and we had a tremendous interaction, I'll say. It's something that's outside of my wheelhouse. Why don't you tell a little bit about yourself, refresh everybody about what you do.
Well, my name is Jim Jarrus. I'm from Northwest Indiana. Just outside of the city of Chicago limits, probably 20 minutes away and just south of Lake Michigan. I spent about 24 years in the fire service, and primarily, although I rode the ambulance, the engine, a snorkel, if anybody still remembers what snorkels are.
Yes.
then I was also in fire prevention, and one of the duties within the Fire Prevention Bureau was hazmat compliance and dealing with Tier 2 forms and local emergency planning committees and talking to different businesses about some of the stuff that they store and use and dispose of and so forth, and making sure that everything is regulated properly for the safety of not only the public, but primarily for firefighters that have to respond. So that was one of my jobs, and pretty much had a great career, and that was part of it.
Awesome, man. You know, and I think everybody that's listening knows I'm pretty hardcore into the hazmat response. So when I put my application to the National Fire Academy across my chief's desk and said, "Hey, I would like to go to this," he's like, "This is not really in your lane." This, you know, because where I work, I don't do hazmat codes. I don't do code enforcement. I don't do building inspections. All I do is hazmat. It's a luxury that I'm very happy to have. But I basically, worked him over until he signed it. And everybody laughed at me. They all said, "You're going to the National Fire Academy for what? Codes? That's why would you even want to do that?" And I sat in this class, and I was surrounded by 25 people that were all they did was codes. And I was a fish out of the water, right? So I got to say that the two instructors, Jim and Cotton, really brought this back. But what I wanted to bring on this podcast about is that I didn't even know what I didn't know. Like, you know, like I was honestly, I was able to, for 6 days, peek over the fence at the code enforcement. What do you think, how does hazmat response interact with hazmat codes?
Well, I'll tell you what, I think the responders, in order to be effective at response, and I say that, let me take it back a second. I say this in every class, you know, I really do care about public safety, but I care mostly about making sure that the firefighters are safe and they understand what they're getting involved in, and nobody likes surprises. I'm not a big fan of roller coasters. So I want to know what I'm getting into. And I think the correlation between response and the codes is that the responders need to understand when they look at a building and they're doing a size up, it's not just the type of construction, how many stories, the square footage, anything like that. It's also what's that building being used for? What's the nature of the occupants that are inside that building? And what's inside there that's going to bite me? And when you're dealing with hazmats, every occupancy, be it an assembly use or a daycare or a healthcare facility or any other number of things, has their own inherent requirements. And it doesn't take much for a hazmat responder to sit down and look at the code. And they're all online and you can get them for free, you know, spend an afternoon in a firehouse, even make a drill out of it and look at some of those requirements and say, if we were to respond to a big box discount store, department store, without naming any names, there's two big ones out there, big rivals. What do they have? How much of it do they have? Where do they have it? And what could potentially happen? I think it's important to sit down with those code folks and just say, "Can you give me a little guidance? Tell me what you're looking at when you see these different buildings," because it's more than just exit signs and emergency lights. The real meat and potatoes is within those walls that we really are a little bit apprehensive, and a lot of people are apprehensive of looking at the hazmats and figuring out maximum allowable quantities and so forth.
I got to say, the real pickup I had in the class was that these guys and girls are doing code enforcement, which everybody kind of rolls their eyes like, "Oh, here comes the guys that are going to make, cost me a lot of money." And I don't look at those things. I come in after the spill has occurred. So these guys are basically pre-planning for me. And that's the value that I got out of the class, is that while working with these people that I don't interact with almost at all, I gained an appreciation to what they did and why they did it. Their whole operation, their whole thought process is protect the firefighters, protect the cops, protect the people in order to, you know, stop me from working, basically.
That's you know, very true. I mean, you know, it's almost like a competition. Any day that the wheels don't turn in the firehouse is a good day for fire prevention.
Right. Yeah, I was in when they started talking about codes, and again, I'm keeping quiet because I don't want to show how illiterate I am in codes. So I was keeping quiet for a little while. What were the main ones that you think that people in emergency response could get something out, and why?
Well, I think first of all, there's two different things that emergency responders need to know for a basic. And let's take it back all the way to the beginning here. When somebody gets on a fire department, they get the badge and they get the blue shirt and everything, suddenly, and maybe it was the same for you as it was for me, you suddenly become the fire expert. And people say, well, where do you put the smoke detector? And where do you put this? And you're like, I just got hired. You know, I don't know.
Right.
So taking that same concept of looking at hazmat codes, understanding that there's two code bodies. The International Code Council produces or publishes the fire code, the building code, and a lot of other codes that correlate with that. NFPA.
Like plumbing and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, plumbing, fuel gas, mechanical, and so forth. All right. Those are very important, and they talk to each other. NFPA, okay. National Fire Protection Association, also publishes a fire code, a building code, and all the standards that correlate with the codes, both ICC and NFPA. So recognizing that first as a responder, there's two code groups that are out there. Now, the first thing that the responder needs to do is contact their Fire Prevention Bureau, find out which of the two code bodies are being enforced within your jurisdiction. Secondly, once you find that out, looking at the fire code and looking at the building code, the building code is going to tell you how the building was built and what its use is going to be, what it's going to be classified as. The fire code is going to be a maintenance code for that building code, essentially. But when you get into the fire code, and let's say in the ICC, you get to Chapter 50, that's the hazmat general provisions. Get to Chapter 50 and beyond, all the way to 67. Those are going to be all the different hazmat codes. So if you simply look at the table of contents and you say, well, I'm dealing today with, let's say, aerosols, for example.
Okay.
Go to the table of contents, find the chapter that addresses that, and you can read through it. Likewise with NFPA, same general concept. You can look at the table of contents and it'll walk you right through. But I think that's a baseline for the responders to get to know what they're dealing with. The second thing I think responders need to know is you can only shove so much stuff in a space, and the codes all have limits, and they're called maximum allowable quantities for any kind of product that's out there, regardless of what the hazmat is or chemical is. There's a certain limitation as to how much you can have in a building based on its use. So if you understand assembly, educational, institutional, business, mercantile, and all those, then you can say, well, I'm allowed to have, I'm just arbitrarily saying, 10 pounds of this product and 100 pounds of that product in this occupancy. That should make the hazmat responder's job a little easier. And they can go, well, I can anticipate this big of a spill or this much of a release based on the occupancy. So looking at the code and being able to say, oh, you know, this is a daycare. I might see a gallon or two of Clorox, or I might see a couple containers of some other cleaner. Shouldn't be too terrible. But that's where the code's going to play a big role in their ability to respond in a little bit wiser way, smarter way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that was one of the actual scenarios that kind of surprised me. It's one of those clarifying moments where the daycare that Jim was just talking about was one of the specific things. And I want to say that they were okay to have, you know, 1 gallon of Clorox or bleach or disinfectant. However, they had 6 gallons. And one of the nuances, those little caveats in the code was, well, they can have 1 gallon open. They can have like 5 in storage. Or so, was that something? Am I saying it correctly?
You have what's products in use and products in storage. So the next thing is to think about, let's use gasoline. Gasoline's a very common product. Using it, filling up a lawnmower. Let's say you have a lawn care company. They're filling up a lawnmower, that's in use. The stuff in the big yellow cabinet, that's in storage. And being able to recognize those two different features. And it gets deeper than that as you get more into, let's say, lab work, or you're doing a special process, maybe chrome plating or something like that of bumpers. Yeah, now you're going to be dealing with a different animal that might have bigger restrictions as to how much can actually be stored there.
Yeah, so the IC, I just, and this is another thing that I kind of learned as I'm assuming that the majority of the people that are listening hopefully won't be so much in the dark as I was. But coming out, I have a little bit more of a ground ball, I guess, approach to this thing now. And what one of the things I learned, and this might be simple for some of you, but that the ICC, mm-hmm. right, is the overarching international level, and then it goes down to the NFPA, slightly more restrictive.
Yes, right? NFPA has the standards too. So let's say, for example, you're dealing with the gasoline, the motor oil, and so forth. NFPA 30 is what would be referenced for flammable and combustible liquids. Also, ICC has Chapter 57, which deals with flammable uh-huh. combustible liquids. But yeah, NFPA tends to have the standards, the explanatory reasons why and how things should be done, pretty thoroughly covered.
Right. And where I live, I work in New York City, so we have our own fire code, which is going to be even more restrictive than those other two.
Yeah, you know, and that's the other thing, too. A lot of big cities have their own codes. New York, Chicago has a fire prevention code. I'm sure, you know, L.A., Atlanta, places like that probably have either their own code or a version of the ICC or NFPA, for that matter, with amendments to it. So recognizing what you're enforcing in your own jurisdiction first is really going to be essential for the foundation for response.
Yeah. I there was a couple of times where I was reading through the codes and I was like, huh? Oh, so that's why they do that. Oh, look at that.
Yeah. You bring up a good point too. The other thing too, is if a responder can get with the code official, you know, and a lot of places do pre-plans, they do walkthroughs, they do pre-incident planning and so forth, planning for that fire. Get out with those fire code guys and see what they are doing. Walk through a building with them and let them explain, this is why the product has to be in a spill containment proof, you know, area or room, or ventilation has to be provided for this at a certain CFM rate. That might tell the responders. And here's the other thing, Bobby. You know, as a code person, I'm looking at the building a certain way. With you standing next to me, I might say, well, we have to have ventilation in this room for X amount of air exchanges per hour. I know the code says that. I'm not sure why. And you might be able to say, because this product does this and this and behaves this way if it's released into the air. So, you know, you can almost tag team the compliance issue, and everybody's a winner at that point.
Yeah, that was one of the – what you just said there is like the combining of the heads. Like, as I said many a time in here, that I was completely out of my element. I knew – I have a depth of knowledge in hazmat response. I understand interactions, chemicals, blah, blah, blah. These guys do not know anything about hazmat response. They don't know binary acids. They don't know pumping techniques. They do not know anything. They know codes. And so it was a little bit of time before I found my function in this group. But I will say that once I started helping them, there was a couple of chemicals where it was like, what was it? Ethyl alcohol. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, that's ethanol, right?
Or ethylene oxide is a big one that's out there now. You know, a lot of areas
dealing with it. But I was able to, like, off the top of my head, give them synonyms and give them interactions and why these things. So I ended up, towards the end of the class, helping these guys understand their job better. And these guys ended up helping me do my job better.
Yeah.
I got to say, I was very impressed with the whole class.
Yeah, and it's thanks. It was a good class, and I think everybody worked hard throughout the whole thing. I really enjoyed working with everybody at all the tables. But the thing, you're right, man. The thing is, you know, if you can say to the inspector, this is what's going to happen when you open that bottle. I can look at something and say, you're allowed to have that bottle on the shelf, and it's fine as long as it doesn't exceed that quantity or it doesn't go into a different container or anything like that. And you can say, well, if you take that stuff out of the brown glass jar and you put it into the cardboard tube, this is what's going to happen. That tells that code official, well, wait a second. They also have this other stuff in the room here. What can happen? Yeah. And now you can really prevent any kind of catastrophe from occurring by just looking at that and saying, yeah, this is these two mixed together and it's in the wrong container and it leaks through that container or something. Yeah, now you've got
kablooey.
If you didn't hear yet, we are transitioning to a new format that is going to give you, the listener, even more content.
Yeah, for example, in our technician and specialist levels, we are adding even more video content, access to our entire show catalog, and even access to a monthly small group Q&A session to answer any questions that come up, as well as so much more.
All of this for less than a cup of coffee that you premium snobs like to drink for the entire month of access.
This is the stuff that you've been asking for. So take a look at what we can do to take you to the next level of Hazmat.
Go to our website, thehazmatguys.com. You can sign up for our premium tiers that will give you even more Hazmat goodness.
Yeah, we were talking, I know, and I'll mention it, Home Depot, right? We were talking about Home Depot, the cleaning solution aisle. And when we started really looking at the aisle with all the different things in it, and you start looking about how, and I'm just picking on Home Depot because they actually do it right. Their stores are actually, now that I have an eye towards the code, their stores are broken up. The aisle and the sectioning and the distances are all broken up to precisely go to code.
Yeah.
I just thought, you know, oh, well, tools are next to the screws because it can't be, because it just works out that way. No, they're actually separating, like, roofing materials from the commodities that interact with it by X distance.
And if you think about it, too, yeah, you're absolutely right. And it doesn't have to specifically be hazmat. You can think about plastics that might be, you know, any number of lawn furniture, you know, in springtime right
now.
You can put lawn furniture on a rack storage unit, and then you've got an aisleway that might be 4, 6, 8 feet, maybe even wider, away from that rack to the next rack, and that also that essentially becomes a fire break. So let's say, for example, the plastic stuff catches on fire, it's not going to radiate over, or it shouldn't, based on the distance that's calculated, radiate over to the next rack. But I'll say this also, it's imperative that fire inspector walk those aisles and look at the material that's being stored and recognize that they're allowed to have X amount of pounds of product or X amount of gallons of whatever it is, because if it does catch fire, based on what that limitation of material is, that will reduce the potential for, I'm not going to say eliminate, but it'll reduce the potential for it to radiate over, and it'll allow for the fire sprinkler systems as designed to either hold that fire or to extinguish that fire. If you exceed those maximum allowable quantities, I can't tell you if that sprinkler system's going to handle it or if it's not going to radiate or anything like that. But, you know, and it's not just the one store you mentioned, it's many stores. You know, they look at that and they look at stocking plans and so forth. And they say, well, you know, not only is it springtime, we got plastic furniture, we also have lawn care, fertilizers, different types of chemicals like that, that may need to be put off to a certain area or a certain side, or only this much can be inside, the rest has to be outside. That's a big thing too. And we talked about that in class, inside versus outside storage and the location on property with respect to the buildings and the property line, because you got to think about your neighbor also, the person in the next building over, could you be exposing them to a hazard? Yeah. One of the other things too we talked about, which is another thing to consider, environmental requirements. Where is that water going to run off to that we're using for fire extinguishment? Is that something that could cause harm to other things, like such as vegetation, to other animals, those sort of types of things? So, you know, if you start looking at the bigger picture of a lot of the potential for a fire to occur, there's a lot of impact there. You know, where I live, I have well water where I'm at.
Okay.
And about 610 feet south of me is a series of pipelines. So am I concerned about that? Of course I am. If there's any kind of failure of that line underground, how is that going to impact me, my neighbors, anything like that? And could be catastrophic. So working together and recognizing how much stuff you can have in a building will tell that responder, tell you, hey, this is how big it's. Is it going to be a bang or a boom? One of the two. Yeah. And then is it going to be something we can handle? Or are we going to have, this is going to be an all-night affair that we're going to be dealing with? And that inspector can really show that responder, this is the occupancy, this is how much of this stuff you can have inside or outside, and so on. You know, in what form and what storage container, and what's allowed to be, you know, because that's the other thing, Bobby, we talked about allowable increases. So if you're allowed to have, let's say, for example, 25 pounds of one product in a building, but you need more because of production requirements, sprinkler right. system in, you can double it. You put it in a certain type of cabinet, you can have more. And when somebody walks into a room and they go, holy cow, there's a lot of stuff in here. Well, this is why. Because we have
right.
additional fire protection features. We've put in rated walls, rated doors. So that should help contain that fire if it starts, eliminate all the ignition sources, have electrical equipment that's installed in accordance with NFPA 70. National Electrical Code. So all those little caveats, I guess you could say, to that material play a big role in potentially reducing that fire and not allowing it to start in the first place.
Yeah, I think, and again, this is maybe the businessman in me coming out in this, is that one of the major takeaways I had, and it's not part of the class, they don't teach this part of the class, it's just something I kind of observed, was that if you go to any store, right, and even anything from a mom and pop all the way up to these big box mega shops, they have code and compliance guys at the corporate level or whatever it is. You know, they work with the fire prevention officer, the codes enforcement guy, and then it's over. They go away, right? So now code enforcement, they know, comes in every year. Oh, this is the guy that cost me money. And what I saw was that this would be an incredible opportunity for any fire department, any emergency service, to have a public outreach. Let us come in. Let us help you understand why these codes are important. And let us figure out the most economical, most safe, most expedient way of us satisfying everybody goes home safe kind of thing, where you're going to lose the least amount of product if you go down because of a fire. We're going to lose the least amount of life because of that fire. Everybody wins if we all educate.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, I remember back in 08, 09 when we had the recession, and it was everything we could do to work with area businesses and say, listen, we want to keep your doors open. We're doing the best we can to educate you on what you need to do to remain compliant. And, I mean, it was tough times. If some of the listeners remember back to when businesses were closing on a regular basis, unemployment was going, it was kind of scary, you know.
Yeah.
But being a partner, you know, I tell people all the time, they call it a firehouse because it's in the neighborhood. You should be a part of that neighborhood, be a part of that business community, and be a resource for them. And the sad thing is as much as I did inspections over the years, people were scared. They're like, oh, this guy's going to cost me money. The reality of it is you're almost like a municipal, I hate to use the word consultant, but you're the guy that can sit down with that business and tell them, listen, this is what you need to have. Oh, and by the way, let me introduce you to the folks that are going to show up and respond to your incident when everything else that we've put in place fails. The alarm, the sprinkler, the walls, the ignition, whatever. These are the guys that are going to show up, and they're going to do their best to hold this thing to just one little area so that we can get you back in business again.
Yeah, I completely changed my – I thought always fire prevention and codes enforcement was going to be the monetary aspect of the fire department, the county, the town, whatever the hell it is. They're the guys that generate the revenue. And now that is – I mean – and I mean that through fines and stuff like that. But if the department is doing it right, there shouldn't be any fines.
No, there really shouldn't. I mean, you know, obviously – a lot of communities have penalties in place for people that are non-compliant, and there are, sad to say, there are businesses out there that are going to do their best to push the envelope and get by with totally. As much as possible. You know, but I think by and large, I want to believe that most businesses, they want to be legit, they want to do the right thing, and that's yeah. where the inspector can help, and that's where. Once they see the responders, you know, everybody sees the big red trucks rolling down the road and they recognize, oh, yeah, there goes the fire truck. There goes the fire truck to somebody's disaster is where that thing's going. You know, don't let it be coming to your address, you know, plant.
Good point.
You know? So
yeah.
The
well, yeah, dude, it was honestly eye-opening. I don't know if anybody's going to buy on this this class, but I would take this again.
That's great.
I would take this again. I would honestly take this again, and I would urge anybody, and I'll put the link into the show notes on this episode on the link on how to apply to the National Fire Academy. It is all inclusive, you know, soup to nuts. They pay for everything. Yeah.
They even have top karaoke notch. On Wednesdays, you know, if you're into that.
What a racket.
I gotta tell you, though, you know, about the class, there are a few things that I think a lot of people don't recognize as a value to them, and one of them is the Tier 2 reports that businesses that store, use, dispose of hazmats send to the local fire department. Those are excellent tools for you to pass along to responders. So that those responders know what they're going to be getting into also. Everybody knows a gas station has gasoline, but who knows what, let's say, an aquatic store has for maintaining fish tanks and stuff like that, those chemicals. Well, you might see them in a Tier 2. Or you might have a local college or university that has a laboratory, and you're going to get a couple different documents. You might get the Tier 2. You also might get a hazmat inventory statement. You also might get a hazmat management plan. And those three documents right there tell you, hey, this is what we have here. We're putting you on notice that this is the chemicals. That management plan tells you this is what we're going to do in case we have a spill or release of a chemical. Take a look at those plans. When you get the Tier 2s at your local fire department, go to the Prevention Bureau. They come in between January and March. Go to the Fire Prevention Bureau. Review those, find some of those target hazards in your community and see what they have. Visit with those places. And when you look at their management plan and they say, well, we're going to put, I'm just making this up, we're going to put kitty litter on this thing and we're calling 911. Well, is that enough for an emergency responder, or do you need to be part of that plan also? So that's really important. So it's a document that can also be taken to the next level with the county local emergency planning committee. And most every county has one. Get involved with that. Find out when the meetings are. Sit in the back of the room. Observe. And the board is primarily, the committee is primarily made up of business owners, industrial representatives from your community that might be an excellent resource for you as well to get more information on, hey, we only have X amount of gallons of foam on our trucks. Somebody in the industrial world in your county might be able to say, well, you know what, we've got this and we can work with you in case there's a major emergency. Just using that for an example. So there's other places out there that local fire departments, especially small departments, that may not have the resources that like you guys do, Bobby, but volunteer departments especially, rural areas, anything like that. It might be a little bit of a time delay before somebody can get there, but knowing that LEPC and what else is available to you, you know, it's invaluable, you know.
I love this, Jim. Thank you so much for coming on and
of course.
help me enunciate all my fears, and it's like a therapy session right now. This is great.
Yeah, the key, I think the key takeaway from this is evaluate your community, find out what kind of businesses are there, and then start, you know, just peel back that onion a little bit and see what kind of stuff they have inside. Work with the business owners. They, you know, a lot of times too, the business owner might say, we didn't realize that this mixed with this created this, and right. Now what are we going to do? You know, and sometimes you can work with those folks and reduce anything from happening and keep them in business, keep them making money, paying taxes, and go from there.
This is awesome. Jim, tell us where we can find you more if we want more information.
Well, I'll give you a couple resources here. First off, if you're looking for me, firecodeguy@gmail.com. It's pretty simple, firecodeguy@gmail. And if you're looking for code resources, ICCSAFE.org is the website for the International Code Council. You'll have to navigate the website a little bit, but you can actually read the codes for free. I don't believe you can print or download or anything like that, but you can at least read them. NFPA is nfpa.org. Likewise, you can read the codes for free. You just can't print or download or copy, cut, paste, anything like that. You have to create a little username and password, but it's free. The other thing, too, is when you start looking at those NFPA standards, there's a technical committee that writes each one of those. Take a look at the names on the technical committees. See if there's anybody within your area. Reach out to those folks and just say, listen, we're having a issue about this, or I have a few questions about that. Those people are the ones that help put those codes and standards together. They're an excellent resource for you as well if you need some more technical information on whatever the product that might be. And I'm sure that they'll be happy to share most anything with you as far as getting you on the right track to making sure that everybody stays safe.
That's so awesome. Thank you so much, Jim. I'm hoping we can get you back.
And it was great having you in class. And for you people out there that listen that are inspectors, reach out to your hazmat responders too. You know, partner with those folks and find out when you look at something in a certain quantity amount, what that thing can really do if it's released. So it's important so that the message goes both ways.
Well, that wraps up another episode of the Hazmat Guys. You can find us at Facebook, Twitter, and our YouTube channel. And don't be afraid to use that like or follow button. Or
you can sign up for even more content from us at thehazmatguys.com. Here, you can subscribe so that we can connect you to even more great stuff. Your support is going to help us improve and build this awesome community even more.
Yeah, and if you want to get to the next level, you won't want to miss our premium content. Our specialist level provides you with access to our entire catalog of shows, which is now over 300, an exclusive Facebook group, premium video with no ads, and so much more. Also, check the Hazmat Guys University link on our website.
And don't forget, we are always interested in hearing about incidences or calls that you have experienced. We may bring you on the show to share that story. Reach us at feedback@thehazmatguys.com.
And remember, folks, don't just get on the job, get into the job.